Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
In our episode today, our guest is a repeat guest that we've had. Earlier this year in January, we had Jerry Bullard on to kind of give us a forecast of what the Texas legislature might be looking at doing this session. And now that we've ended the regular session and we're now into multiple special sessions, we thought we'd have Jerry back to just kind of give us the rundown of what happened, what's going on right now, and maybe things that we can keep an eye out for in the future that might come back around from this last session. Jerry, welcome back. And if you would just kind of tell us briefly who you are, what you do for listeners who may not have heard our prior episode with you.
Oh, happy to do that, Jody. Thank you. First of all, thank you for having me back. I like to think of myself probably as more of a repeat offender than a repeat guest. I'll try to make sure I have manners this time. So now, I'm Jerry Bullard. I'm with Adams, Lynch & Lofton, a law firm in the Mid-Cities. I consider myself to be a Fort Worth lawyer, even though I'm technically not in Fort Worth proper, but I'm a appellate practitioner primarily, like Jody and Todd, but I've been tracking the legislature. It's about 2004, just primarily to keep an eye on what's going on, not necessarily because I can do anything to affect legislation, but primarily as a public service to those in the bar and that are sitting on the bench too, that like to know what's going on in Austin, because we all can't keep up with everything that goes through a legislative session. Even though they meet every 2 years, there's a lot of things done during that 6 month period of time, almost 6 months, that affects our profession. So, and like I said, I've been doing that for almost 17 years now. So I enjoy doing it. I don't know what that tells you about me or what, how my mind works.
You're an appellate lawyer.
I'm happy to provide the service. So
just roughly how many bills get filed in a regular session?
Well, you know, it's usually around 7,000 or so, at least in recent times. This past session, there were 6,927 bills filed, which is, historically speaking, the third highest total of bills that our legislature has been asked to address. And usually when I say bills, it also includes resolutions that could end up being a resolution that puts some issue on the ballot in November to amend our Constitution. So, you know, like I said, we almost had 7,000. Our high watermark was in 2009, where we had 7,419. And then last session, we had 7,324. So, you know, around 6,000-7,000 is not unusual in terms of bills that actually get filed. Of course, that doesn't mean they get all dealt with. Some of them just die on the vine. But that's the number we're usually looking at. So, and if you want to know as far as passage rates, this session, we had 1,073 that passed, which was kind of a, you know, struck me as being somewhat of a low number, believe it or not. And when I went back and looked at the stats, you know, the last time there were fewer than 1,000 bills passed by our legislature was in 1991. So, which, you know, that was 960. So, you know, that was only about 100 fewer, I guess, than that low water mark, at least from my standpoint, of the last 20 or 30 years. The last session, we passed 1,429. And I think in 2009, that may have been the highest number while it was 1,400. So, you know, there was a lot of work put on their plate to deal with. For various reasons, they obviously didn't get as much work done as they had in the past, but they were busy.
Well, one thing we covered in some detail the last time you were here was about your email mailing list and the service that you provide to Texas lawyers and others who want to stay abreast of what's going on in the legislature, the current status of bills and so forth. I think we should refer folks back to that previous episode, because I know we provided them with the information of how they could get on the list and all of that. So, but it's worth mentioning, you've continued to keep us apprised since you were last here of what bills have been filed that may affect civil. You really focus on civil litigation practice and civil litigants, I guess is accurate to say. And of course, how they're faring in the various process that they have to go through to ultimately be passed into law and signed by the governor. So if anyone is interested in getting into that kind of detail, I'd certainly refer them back to your list, because as I said before, you've done you do a great job of keeping us informed about what's happening in the legislature, and particularly the bills that may come to affect civil litigation practice in Texas.
Thank you for that plug, and I'm happy to, you know, add anybody to the list who wants to be on it. So the more the merrier.
You know, kind of taking this sort of backwards, I guess, I've noticed in your recent emails that you've said that few, if any, of the bills pending in special session are actually expected to impact civil practice in Texas. Is that still the case?
Yeah, that's still the case. You know, there was some thought, and we may talk about this later, but there was some thought we may see some legislation to deal with appellate court redistricting or remote proceedings. There was some thought perhaps that could show up again. That does not look like it's going to be the case for either one of those two topics. So right now it's things like redistricting overall, you know, vaccines, mandates for masks and all that good stuff, you know, things that are in the news that attract the most attention. Yeah.
And that was one of the reasons why we felt comfortable moving ahead, even though we're still in a special session, that, you know, the regular session has come and gone. We kind of know actually the laws generally that were enacted have become effective. That typically happens September 1 generally. And so we don't expect anything to come about after we record this episode that's going to have much of an impact on civil litigation. But we are able now to talk about, you know, how accurate your predictions were, Jerry, and what was going to come about for the regular session.
Well, my predictions are probably about as accurate as your local weatherman. So they still have jobs.
Well, you know, and you don't get paid for this service that you provide for the bar. So it's, I guess everyone should recognize that, you know, you get what you pay for sometimes, but this is a very, very difficult job that you've taken on to not only track these bills, but I mean, nobody expects anybody to offer any kind of prediction with any accuracy. So I say that completely tongue in cheek.
Well, good. And I'll remember that one of these days.
Let's talk about kind of what happened in the first regular session. What are some things that came out of that session that practitioners, lawyers, courts need to know about?
Well, I'll tell you, one of the most popular questions that was asked of me before the session began, and quite frankly, it's been the same question or one of the questions asked since 2014 when this became an issue, was the attorney's fee statute, chapter 38 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code. A little background on that. In 2014, there was I forget which Houston court, but it was one of the court of appeals, had issued a decision that said if you were not an individual or corporation, and you being a defendant, that you are not going to be liable for attorney's fees under Chapter 38, unless, of course, you had a contract or something that provided that you would be responsible for it. And the court interpreted the statute in a fashion that said, since the statute didn't say anything other than individual corporation, that all other entities were excluded from that definition. So your LLCs, your limited partnerships, your GPs, you know, things along those, organizations along those lines, they were not liable under Chapter 38. Well, this session finally have a bill that got across the finish line that amended that statute to include all business organizations as defined under the Business Organizations Code would be subject to attorney's fees under that statute. Now, there was a carve out for nonprofits, for charitable organizations, for churches. But other than that, beginning September 1, all business organizations are going to be caught within that statutory definition of business organizations. So from my standpoint, that's a good thing, because it was causing a lot of confusion, causing a lot of problems for parties who had no idea that they couldn't recover their attorney's fees. So that's a pretty good fix. And just a little more background on that. Every session since 2014, there were multiple bills filed to fix this problem. This session, there were 9, I think, that were filed that would have dealt with it in some form or fashion. And HB 1578 was the bill that got across the finish line. And that was Representative Landgraf's bill, as a representative out of Odessa, I believe. So that was a good fix. And that's one, like I said, a lot of people were asking about. So we'll have to come up with more questions on other topics for future sessions.
Westlaw Edge is the standard for legal research, bringing together a legacy of quality and accurate legal research and the latest advancements in technology. first-of-its-kind features like the next generation of legal search, intelligent document analysis, integrated litigation analytics, and the most powerful citator, expedite research tasks that were once incredibly complex and time-consuming. Westlaw Edge allows attorneys to deliver the fastest answers and gain the most valuable insights, providing a clear strategic advantage. Be a better attorney, make your firm better, and serve your clients better than you have before with Westlaw Edge.
You mentioned how the legislature expanded that statute, and I like the way they did it with, they only changed a few words in the actual statute. And then they referred back in terms of defining what a business organization was, they referred back to the business organizations code. And so if you meet the definition of a business organization, whatever the phraseology is in that code, then you're pulled within chapter 38.001 in terms of being on the hook for attorney's fees. So I thought that was a pretty good, very clear amendment that didn't leave much room for debate, it seems like.
Yeah, I think you're correct. No, except for those carve-outs that I had mentioned, you know, that catches everybody, as far as we know, until someone says otherwise, right?
Right.
And I think the most interesting thing to me is just how long it took to fix what really was not a particularly controversial fix. You know, it's just kind of interesting.
Yeah. No, it was never controversial, at least from what I could tell. When you look at the bill sponsors and those who signed on to the bill, each session for the past, 2015, 17, 19, four sessions, it was not a controversial bill. And like I said, this is where you kind of have to pull back the curtain a little bit to kind of see what's going on. I think if you were to do a little digging, bills that didn't make it across the finish line last time was primarily due to who may have been carrying the bill. If somebody had an axe to grind to get somebody else, then chances are, regardless of how good the bill was, it was not going to get anywhere. And I think that's probably what happened for the most part until this session. So anyway, it's interesting.
Politics. Well, I wonder too, and we may have said something about this before when we were visiting, but you know, there might have been some lobby interests going on in the background with, say, the oil and gas folks who typically operate in LLCs and other structures. That, you know, there's a lot of money at issue there, and there's a lot of lawsuits. And so you just kind of wonder, you know, we're not privy to that information, but you kind of are left to wonder.
Yeah. And there was a rumor that was going around, I know in 2015 for sure, that perhaps there was some oil and gas in the lobbying interest that thought, wait a minute, we kind of like the idea of not having to deal with this, because you're supposed to, y'all know, a lot of times those entities are LLCs or LPs or something like that. They probably kind of liked the way they had that set up. So anyway, all water under the bridge now, though.
That's right.
And then another bill that said attorney's fees related bill was HB 2416, which adds 38.0015 to the Civil Practice and Remedies Code to permit the recovery of attorney's fees as compensatory damages in breach of construction contract cases. Now, that one was so specific that it caused me to do a little digging to figure out, okay, what's going on here? But what I found out was this was really in response to a Supreme Court decision, In Re Nollier Plastic Family Limited Partnership, and it was in 2013. And that was an insurance coverage case where the court said, well, attorney's fees in that instance under your policy are not really, they consider those to be costs. And so those weren't going to be recoverable as compensatory damages under that particular policy. And so I think that was probably the motivator here a little bit to kind of get that fixed. Like I said, it was 2013, so it took a while for that to happen. But I've been told that was the motivator on this bill. And so that's why it's worded in the way that it's worded, and it was tailored to certain types of cases, because those are the ones that typically, I guess, find themselves in some sort of coverage dispute. And so that's the intended fix.
Well, that's really interesting, because in that same case, the Supreme Court also decided a relatively significant supersedious issue about whether attorney's fees had to be superseded. And the rationale for saying no, that they don't, is because they're not compensatory damages. And so it seems like by appeasing, I guess, the insurance industry and providing in these breach of construction contract cases that attorney's fees are compensatory damages, they may have unwittingly complicated supersedious practice a little bit, because now, you know, if you've got that scenario, whereas under the Nollier Plastics decision, attorney's fees didn't have to be superseded ordinarily because they weren't compensatory damages, it's going to create a special rule just for those construction contract claims.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's one of those, you know, always hear about unintended consequences. And, you know, I've not done any drilling down on this particular bill to see if that issue came up in any of the discussions with the legislators who are, you know, pushing the bill. But it wouldn't surprise me if that kind of was under the radar, you know, for some of these folks. But it may have been talked about. I don't know. And they might, you know, everyone may have been able to figure out, okay, we can live with that.
Maybe so. But I guess for those of us that kind of nerd out on supersedious issues, sometimes it's kind of a, we don't get new developments all that often. And so this is one where we're kind of smiling, thinking, all right, can't wait for the next breach of construction contract case to come up to see if we can test this.
Yeah. Well, and a little fun fact associated with this bill is this bill was carried in the House by, let me see here, what was Representative Barbara Gervin Hawkins, who's a Democrat from San Antonio. So for those of you who may recognize at least part of that last name and being from San Antonio, that may be of interest to you to know that I believe that was the Iceman's sister. I believe. Could be wrong. We're certainly related.
For folks outside of Texas, they need to know that the Iceman is George Gervin.
Yes.
Very famous player for the San Antonio Spurs years ago.
Those are really the attorney's fees bills that jumped out at me. And they may have been the only significant ones that passed. At least those are the ones that were the most significant to me. Now, I can talk about, for the appellate nerds, I've got some interesting interlocutory appeals bills.
Let's do it. Oh, because we have not had enough of those. So I'm glad to hear that they're starting to really put some meat into that statute where we have some interlocutory appeals finally.
One of the other more popular questions I get from practitioners is, okay, what sort of, and they're from judges too, is, okay, were they going to create another interlocutory appeal that our courts are going to have to deal with? And, you know, it seems like there's always something, right? There's always some bill that deals with that issue. Well, we have a few. And one of them is HB 286 and dealt with Texas Department of Transportation contractors. And what that bill would do was amend the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, CPRC 51014, which is the interlocutory appeal statute, interlocutory orders. It would permit an interlocutory appeal of orders granting or denying summary judgment motions filed by TxDOT contractors. And you may ask, okay, so why are we providing that remedy for contractors? Well, the senator who carried the bill over on the Senate side, he said, well, the answer is an easy one. He said, because since TxDOT contractors are given immunity to some degree, sovereign immunity, because of their relationship to TxDOT, they ought to have the same remedy TxDOT has, which is a right to interlocutory appeal for those summary judgment orders. Now, the caveat to that is, as long as the contractor is providing its services and it's doing repairs and construction work on TxDOT projects and they're complying with the contract documents. So if there's a construction defect or some sort of condition that causes injury, as long as they're doing that work and their work caused that problem, then they're entitled to this remedy. So that one went into effect June 16, by the way. So that's been on the books already for a few months. And it went into effect that early because it had almost unanimous support on both sides of the aisle in both chambers. So that's why it went into effect so quickly.
Is that one that stays the whole case if you appeal?
You know, I don't remember.
I'm not quizzing you. I just didn't know if you knew.
You know, I think that it probably would if TxDOT had that right.
Yeah, it seems like it would.
To them as well, but I'd have to double check on that one. So, but that's a good question, Jody. And then let's see, bill number two that's in this category was SB 6, which deals with responses to the pandemic situation, which this is one of those little interlocutory appeals that's buried in another bill of importance that the legislature dealt with or they thought they needed to deal with dealing with liability coming out of the pandemic. So I think everybody agreed going in that there would be some need to protect businesses and healthcare providers for those who continued to operate and provide services during the pandemic. SB 6 provides some liability protections for the providers of healthcare services, for volunteers who provide those services, for businesses who continue to operate during the pandemic, and for those who supplied, you know, PPE, you know, our mask manufacturers, glove manufacturers. So there was a desire to create some liability protection for them, you know, as long as they didn't engage in intentional or reckless misconduct of some sort that caused someone to be exposed and contract COVID. They were going to have some liability protection under this bill. But also in this bill was a nice little component that dealt with expert reports, if you're going to file a lawsuit to try to recover for COVID exposure, that you're going to have to produce an expert that tells everybody that, hey, this was the cause of them contracting the disease. And if that expert report is sufficient or insufficient, depending on where you are, then that's subject to an interlocutory appeal. I don't know how many cases are going to get filed out of, you know, issue, but everybody pretty much agreed the legislature was going to, that needed to do something and did do something, deal with this that's been happening across the nation. I mean, that bill, like I said, that was had near unanimous support too. And so it went into effect June 14th. So it's on the books now.
So it's a little bit like a Med-Mal, and it sounds like almost.
Yes. Since it also deals with businesses operating and, you know, providing PPE, no matter inside or outside the medical profession. Yeah, but it operates the same, Jody. You're right, like a Med-Mal.
So that wouldn't have been codified in CPRC 51.014 then. It's probably codified. What's the statute?
Yeah, you're right. That one's not in CPRC. Let me see here. I've got some notes, but I'm going to have to flip around to that.
Well, don't spend any time looking.
We're not trying to stump you. Sorry.
Okay, well, you know, I ought to know that, really, but let's see. Well, it's in the Civil Practice and Remedies Code and the Medical Liability Act, so I'm not exactly sure. Well, you know what? Actually, that part of it is in 51.014.
Okay.
Oh, actually, they did get it right in terms of putting it in the right spot.
Okay.
At least the interlocutory appeal part.
Those ones that are, you know, buried somewhere else deep in the heart of the state codes, those are the ones to watch out for.
Yeah. You know, the legislature has a good group called the Legislative Council. Y'all are probably familiar with it, but, you know, their job is to try to locate where all the statutes are affected by what bills are passed. And they do a really good job of making sure that, you know, what happens in one part of the code is dealt with in the other part of the code when they have an opportunity to. You know, sometimes amendments are made on the floor or on the fly. It doesn't go through Leg Council. And that's when you get problems, Todd, like you had described, where some remedy is going to be buried somewhere else that no one knows about.
And then you have to rely on O'Connor's or somebody to give you a table of all the new statutes that affect these things. But, you know, as you say, the council does a good job of trying to keep there from being too many gotchas in this situation.
Yeah, oh, you're right. So they did cross their T's on that one. And then the last one real quick, unless y'all want me to take a breath.
No, please.
Okay. Is SB 232, which deals with healthcare liability expert reports. That amends Chapter 74 of the CPRC, which is the Medical Liability Act, Jody, that you had mentioned a while ago. It adds a preliminary determination for an expert report requirement to the statute. So now if someone files a lawsuit that may or may not be subject to the Medical Liability Act, they can ask the judge to make a preliminary determination as to whether or not an expert report is required. And once that determination is made, that generates another opportunity for an interlocutory appeal. So I think the policy behind this one makes some sense because we have lawyers who, you know, didn't know whether they had a Medical Liability Act claim. We're all familiar with the cases where a court will decide, well, no, this one really isn't, or it is. And you're kind of going, well, okay, I don't know about that. But they went that way. And then poor plaintiff may be out of luck and didn't have much of a remedy. But this bill would fix that. And this is, once again, this is one of those that got broad support across the aisle, both chambers. But the interesting thing about this bill is the governor didn't sign it. He just let it go into law, you know, without his signature. So sometimes that sends a message. Not sure what that's here, but that's what happens. So
it does seem like a good fix because you're right. I mean, I've seen so many cases in which a plaintiff, a lawyer made the decision or maybe just didn't even come up on their radar screen about whether this might be a healthcare liability claim. And they suffer the consequences if the courts determine that it is, and there was no expert report filed. So better to have that determination early and get that out of the way and then not have to litigate on an appeal for potentially for years, only to have the result completely wipe out everything that's been.
Well, and if anybody listening handles these types of cases, you know, there are some timelines in there in terms of when you need to raise these issues. And if it's determined, if the expert report is determined to be insufficient or you need one, then there's a timeline for that to be cured. And also there's some timelines that the Court of Appeals makes a determination sent back that someone could still fix it. There's some details in the bill that kind of help with those types of issues and those questions. And that concludes the interlocutory appeal component.
You know what? That is such important stuff. You know, I'm looking at the statutes right now, and it doesn't look like, and this is based on just, you know, the Texas statutes website, it looks like they may not have put in stays, which may be an oversight that they may have to fix later. So just throwing that out there, check the statute because these new things may or may not give rise to a stay currently.
Yeah, or at least an automatic stay. That's what you're talking about there.
Yeah. I don't know that they hooked them into the new subsections, but anyway, that's neither here nor there.
That's a great question. So, and then I guess moving on to another topic, if that's okay. Now, usually I always look for in the appellate nerds that we are, if there's what I usually a bill I always like to refer to as the Texas Appellate Lawyer Employment Act. There always seems to be some sort of legislation, you know, that gives us something to really chew on. And I think that bill this session will be HB 19, is the bill dealing with civil actions involving commercial motor vehicle accidents. That was one of the tort reform bills, if you want to put a label on it other than what I just called it, that generated a lot of interest by the plaintiff's bar and the defense bar, especially if you're handling trucking cases. And, you know, every time I read that bill, I see something new in there and I see something different and I have more questions that come to mind in terms of how those cases are going to be tried. You know, I don't handle a lot of commercial motor vehicle accident cases. I've had a couple, but I don't roll around in the details of those types of cases as much as I probably will now so I can figure this thing out. But essentially what that bill does is, like I said, there's a lot of detail in the bill, but it creates another bifurcated trial system. If you have an employer who's going to stipulate that an employee who was involved in an accident was in the course and scope of his employment, and you do that within a certain time frame, then that creates another potential bifurcated trial that you're going to have to deal with finding not only the liability for the accident, but whether or not an employer may have some liability if for a negligent hiring or entrustment situation if the plaintiff alleges it. You know, and that's in addition to the bifurcated trial system we already have now that's provided for your basic negligence and your punitive or your gross negligence determinations, you know, or punitive damages. You know, I've talked to some folks that, okay, this means we could have three different trials essentially in one trial potentially. And some will say, well, no, that doesn't really mean that. But at the end of the day, I don't think we know really in terms of how that piece of this bill is going to work. And then related to that are some admissibility issues for violations of regulatory standards, you know, the CFRs that govern commercial trucking companies and drivers. There's a whole lot of things that deal with in this bill and when that's going to be admissible and when the jury's going to be able to hear those issues. And anyway, there's a whole lot of things to chew on in that particular bill that's probably going to be developed through case law, you know, charge conferences, what that's going to look like, you know, and how are you going to preserve error on that and how they're going to interpret that. And so anyway, that's the one that's going to give us, I think, some work, especially if you spend some time in those areas at all.
Where did that get codified? Transportation code?
Yeah, well, some different places. Let me pull my notes here. We have it being codified.
Sorry, Jerry. I promise we're not trying to stump you.
No, it's okay. No, I have my notes. I've got my paper.
It's an open book test today.
It's in the Civil Practices and Remedies Code. There's new provisions, 72.002, moving forward. And then there is some provisions in the insurance code. So it is codified in the CPRC. It's a new section totally that's going to deal with these types of cases. You know, there's also issues in there in terms of when are you going to have images of the accident scene are going to be admitted instead of making a judge, you know, have to jump through the hoops and get expert testimony before he or she rules on it. There's some admissibility issues that are already dealt with in the bill that I guess is supposed to preempt some of those discretionary rulings. And so anyway, lots of little nuggets there.
Well, how is that going to work? I mean, I guess you've got the statute right in front of you and you're arguing one side or the other of that issue. You're saying, well, Judge, the legislature has determined this for you, what your discretion is, but whatever happened to gatekeeping and applying the rules of evidence?
Yeah, well, you know, I've asked similar questions to that, to yours. And, you know, essentially, this is what it boils down to. I guess there's still going to be some discretion about whether something, you know, whether it's too grotesque, you know, to be admitted into evidence. So you've got the prejudicial, you know, effect outweighing the probative value. You kind of have, you can still make those arguments. What I had been told was, is there were some issues where that would come up where you would have judges either admitting photographs that maybe weren't really accurate representations of the accident scene, whether they were actually photographs of the scene or not, you know. So I think this bill is intended to deal with some of those types of issues. But, you know, this is that's also what's good for the goose is good for the gander. I mean, if you've got a defense lawyer who wants to get certain photographs in, the plaintiff's lawyer is going to say, okay, well, let's get all these other ones in here. Yeah, some of these are pretty grotesque, you know. So there's still going to be a balancing test, I think, for those types of photos and videos. But I think this is intended to kind of cut down on these discretionary rulings that really, they're too discretionary, I guess, to some. Anyway, I'm trying to figure, and I think there's a law review article that's supposed to be written on this bill specifically that provides the perspective from both the plaintiff side and defense side. It's supposed to kind of help everybody be educated as to what this bill actually means. And I'm not sure what the timeline is on that, but I think these issues are going to be covered.
I would hope so. And I mean, surely somebody's going to take a look at whether there's a separation of powers issue here with the legislature telling the courts how to try their cases. I don't know. I haven't thought about that specifically, but just, do we really want to be, we're not only are we in the business of creating all these additional interlocutory appeals, which day in, day out, you know, most appellate lawyers are fine with that because, you know, talk about the Full Employment Act for appellate lawyers. But this is, yeah, I mean, this is a different issue. And I off the top of my head, I can't think of another example. I guess punitive damages, maybe Chapter 41, you know, there's pretty specific procedural provisions there, but I can't think of another example where by statute, the ledge has come in and said, here's how you're going to try your case.
Well, I think part of the problem here, or problem might be a harsh word, depending on what side of the V you're operating on. But there was some concern about juries being asked to fill in too many blanks on the general negligence question. For example, if you had an employer who you alleged was either negligent hiring or supervising or entrusting a vehicle to someone involved in an accident, that there's some discussion about whether or not that's really relevant to whether the driver was negligent at the time of the accident. And so why are we giving all these extra blanks for a jury to complete, to add negligence to the defense side? You know, I guess theoretically take it away from the plaintiff's side, because I guess to add up to 100, someone's going to have to, you're going to divvy all that up. And I understand that to some degree as to why you may not want to have that many blanks on the, you know, on that first question that juries are asked to fill out. So I think that may be kind of what's going on here. So let's separate out the negligence of an employer, make that a separate discussion, separate issue once you get past the negligence of the driver. There was a concern about there being too many verdicts that went askew, went awry, because juries are given opportunities to ask questions and consider evidence they really shouldn't have, at least in the mind of the legislature. That's a long-winded answer to kind of where you were going. I think that's the motivator, I think. And when HB 19 was originally filed, Representative Jeff Leach filed it. He carried it in the House. You know, the bill was a mess. I think everybody would agree it was somewhat of a mess. And he did a great job, you know, in terms of what legislators are supposed to do, of bringing all the stakeholders into discussion to get everybody to, you know, give and take and agree what they could live with. And so when this bill actually passed in the House and the Senate, you know, there was a pretty good consensus in terms of the yay votes. It wasn't necessarily that they supported it, but they could live with it. And so at the end of the day, you know, it had pretty strong, I'm not going to say support. There was a consensus to vote yes on both sides. And I think it may have been like 30-1 on the House and the Senate. That was got modified to the extent that everybody could live with it. So, you know, this is one of those bills that all the stakeholders were pulled in, everybody agreed on something, and which is the way the process is supposed to work, quite frankly. And this is the end result.
It'll be interesting to watch how it develops going forward.
Yeah, no, I agree. I'll be paying attention to that one, obviously, but I'm going to be on the lookout for this Law Review article. I think it'll probably be pretty helpful, at least for those of us who are interested in it. So, you know, and that's really the primary bills that I kept track of that passed that are probably worthy of discussion for purposes of the day, especially for us in the appellate world.
When the stakes are high, decisions must be made quickly, and Court Surety Bond Agency is here to help. As the nation's leading surety agency specializing in supersedious bonds, CSBA can handle any size bond ranging from a small temporary injunction bond to a $1 billion appeal bond. If your client needs protection against judgment enforcement, contact CSBA or visit courtsurety.com today. What about the ones that didn't get there? Were there ones that we were thinking might show up that didn't make it?
Well, the bills that got the most attention, those that didn't make it across the finish line, dealt with the Court of Appeals. I don't know if you want to talk about that now, that could be a topic.
Well, let's talk about it, because I have a feeling it's going to come back around in some form.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think in January, I may have even mentioned this, that there was a bill filed in November on the House side that would have eliminated overlapping jurisdictions or overlapping counties in the 5th, the Dallas Court of Appeals, the Texas County Court of Appeals, which is the 6th, right? I'm getting my numbers right. And then the 12th, which is Tyler. And there's not many of those overlaps there. And quite frankly, those overlaps were negotiated back in 2004, 2005 as to be the only ones left. And that, so when that bill got filed, I thought, this is really odd. So why are we filing this? Because that's all it would have done was eliminate that. And I found out it was a placeholder bill for a larger redistricting effort that was going to be attempted later in the session. And that was in November. And then between November and then April, which is where we'll talk about what the proposal was, there was another bill filed in the House that matched the first bill. And there was a companion in the Senate called Senate Bill 11 that matched the original House bill. In April, a proposed amendment to SB 11 was filed. Senator Huffman was the senator carrying the bill that drastically changed the composition of the Court of Appeals if it had passed. And it was a bill that everybody knew was coming, but no one actually ever got to see until a few days before in terms of what it was going to do to the Court of Appeals. And essentially what it would have done was reduce the Court of Appeals from 14 to 7. And then, you know, the maps are really interesting. I don't have that visual. I think, you know, that would have been, it'd be helpful to have that visual, but I don't have it in front of me. And I probably should have sent it to you and we could probably pull it up somehow. But anyway, you know, it goes from 14 to 7 and it would have maintained the 80 judges that we already have, but they would now be all put on seven courts instead of 14. So what would that have looked like? Well, that would have created, say, a 21 justice court in the Houston Lake Jackson area, an 18 justice court in Dallas and Austin, because those two courts would have been combined, a 15 judge court in the Fort Worth, Eastland, Texarkana, Waco areas. That would have been the new fourth. So you would have had these huge courts and they would have been, you know, that would have changed the boundaries dramatically. So everything would have looked a whole lot different. And the theory behind the change is because, well, we need to make our courts operate more efficiently, eliminate conflicts between courts of appeals, eliminate these overlapping jurisdictions. You know, that was the reason given for the bill when it was filed. It didn't pass. Matter of fact, it was pulled down shortly after it was voted out of the Senate. And there are reasons for why it got pulled down. There was a lot of uproar from not only the Democrat judges on our courts of appeals, but also from the grassroots Republican side, especially in rural areas, because the effect would have been, I think, at least that was their perception. I think they're probably right, that if you make 14 courts seven and you have urban areas that are the hubs of those courts, that a lot of these rural areas are now going to lose their ability to put judges on the courts of appeals. So that makes sense to me. That's a good reason. But in any event, there was enough pushback from various sides to have that bill pulled down. Jody, like you said, I think it's something we're going to see again. And it's just a matter of time.
If you can find that map, Jerry, it would be great. We'll drop a link to it in the show notes for everyone to see. The idea of combining Dallas and Austin into one appellate district is intriguing, shall we say?
Yeah.
The I-35 court, I guess, short of San Antonio.
Well, and you know, and part of that bill was also, that was interesting to me, was that it would also, you know, it would change. When you're combining courts and you have courts that all each have their individual chiefs, then somebody else is going to be designated as the chief. So like the Fort Worth, Eastland, Texarkana court, for example, Waco court, the new chief of that would have been current chief of the Fort Worth court. So the other chiefs would have become just regular associate justices, which, you know, they may not have had a problem with that, but that kind of has some interesting ramifications, obviously, about internal operations and how that works. You know,
the implementation of something like that is okay. Take whatever efficiency you think you're going to gain by consolidating the courts like that, but think about what it's going to be like for a period of years.
Oh, gosh. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it would just be, well, I mean, at some level, I suppose, chaos, but you would have those issues of, I mean, I guess the statutes, the bills, as you say, laid out who was going to become the chief. So I guess that decision would be made. But then how are, you know, are terms going to be staggered differently? How's that going to work? Just an administrative nightmare, I would think.
Well, and now what was also interesting is that some of these judges that are on current courts would have been reallocated or, put into another district. So, for example,
significantly.
And so, Jody, where you and I spent a lot of our time in Fort Worth, one of our justices would have been assigned to the new Houston/Lake Jackson Court of Appeals. So that judge, had that judge wanted to run again after the term expired, would have to relocate to that jurisdiction to be able to run for that seat. Or, you know, if they wanted to stay where they are, then run against somebody who's currently on the Texarkana court. You know, there's just a whole lot of, you know, moving parts to something like that that just really, it didn't make a lot of sense. And from what I was told, there was not a lot of input sought from the stakeholders in this whole deal. So I'm hoping that if this comes back again, stakeholders will be asked to chime in. And, you know, everybody will be able to have some sort of input on this deal because they weren't getting it before.
That certainly was the feeling. It felt very rushed. Maybe, you know, I'm sure that there were reasons behind some of the moves, some maybe more cynical than others, but it really felt like things got thrown out pretty quickly without a whole lot of consideration on practical consequences.
Yeah, yep. There's no question. And I think this hearing, if I remember right, was on April 1st. That was in the
I remember that.
Heard that. And I mean, and this is what was unusual. This bill, along with another one that we can talk about if you want, Texas Court of Appeals bill, I mean, it was considered in that same hearing and voted out of that same hearing the same day after hearing, you know, testimony from those who came down to participate. So it was fast track. Both of them were fast tracked for whatever reason. So interesting stuff. But there's politics involved there also, obviously. But, you know, it's just an interesting way to try to do that.
Well, I think we do have to get at that Texas Court of Appeals bill a little bit, because all three of us will recall the discussion going on in appellate circles and other places about that bill. If you want to refresh everyone's memory, if they don't know what that was all about.
Yeah, that's SB 1529, and it would have created a statewide Court of Appeals district. And so let's pause on that one for a second. So if we're already having a discussion about having too many courts of appeals from 14 to 7, now we have another bill that would have created an additional Court of Appeals that would have, like I said, it had been a statewide court. It would have appellate jurisdiction over cases involving the state, a state agency, state officials, and proceedings in which a party was challenging the constitutionality of a Texas statute. So, you know, that's the sole jurisdiction it had, at least under the bill as proposed. It would have been composed of 5 elected justices. They would sit in Austin, but they could travel and hear cases elsewhere. But what was interesting about this particular bill, besides the subject matter, was that according to OCA, the Office of Court Administration, if you were to take a look at the cases and the number of cases that would fit within the jurisdiction as proposed, we're looking at about 9,500 cases total each year. And so you would have had 9,500 cases to be dealt with by 5 judges. And so, you know, which is when you're talking about what are the caseload that our court appeals deal with now. And I think most judges, if I remember the stats correctly, y'all may know them better than I, but I think most judges handle about 125, 130, 140 cases on their own. So you would have had a court with a small with a small jurisdiction, relatively. And what was interesting about this bill is once it got to the Senate floor, it was amended to increase the compensation of these judges to equal the compensation of a Supreme Court judge. So you would have had an intermediate court of appeals justice getting paid the same amount as a Texas Supreme Court justice and doing a lot less work than your other courts of appeals and their justices there. So, you know, from a financial standpoint, a fiscal standpoint, that one didn't make any sense unless there was going to be, you know, some reason to use that court to expand its jurisdiction later, perhaps to include maybe business disputes.
Business. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's speculation. I'm just me. Yeah. Thinking out loud. No one's told me that, but I think that's kind of the line of thinking, at least I was starting to go down to figure out what else is going on here, other than the political issues that go with trying to pull cases out of Austin for a statewide court or a mini Supreme Court, essentially, to handle, because maybe perhaps someone didn't like what the Third Court of Appeals had been doing with some of these types of cases. Anyway, but that's it. Once again, I'm talking too much, I think.
No, you're really not at all. This is all great stuff. Are there any other things that we may see again on the horizon that were kind of controversial or hot this last session or in specials?
Well, there are 2 other issues. I think, you know, business courts and business trial courts and courts of appeals, that's a bill that continues to be filed. We may see that at some point in time. That this session, one got out of a House committee, but didn't get put to a House vote. But that type of a bill we're always going to see, I think, until something happens, at least to kind of give some folks who think business courts are important and who maybe can get a little bit of relief to address whatever concerns they have. That one's going to be something we see again. But I don't know that we need to spend a lot of time on that one, because I think maybe the more important one that impacts what you and I do, our trial judges deal with, is remote proceedings, your Zoom proceedings. You know, everyone has asked questions about, you know, when are Zoom meetings or remote proceedings appropriate? What types of hearings should they be used for? Which ones are not? And there's a lot of debate, as you would imagine, about when those are appropriate, when there's not. I think the Supreme Court has some jurisdiction. Individual courts have a jurisdiction, maybe the right word, but they've got the authority to kind of provide some rules on those lines. But there was a legislative effort to kind of provide some sort of uniformity to what courts could and couldn't do in terms of remote proceedings. And HB 3611 was the House bill. SB 690 was a Senate bill. This bill would have, you know, authorized trial courts to conduct remote proceedings, but there were some limitations placed on it, such as, I mean, if they were going to have a remote proceeding, all parties had to be notified of it. A party would have an opportunity to object if they didn't want to have a remote proceeding. They'd have to have 10 days, you know, notice of that. And then a court could go in and decide whether or not, you know, their objection is valid or, and how to deal with it. If there were contested criminal proceedings, both sides were going to have to consent. Jury trials in civil district, statutory county, probate or county courts, both sides had to consent if you were going to try a case remotely. Jury trials in just municipal courts, I mean, they could do that too, but they would have to provide an opportunity for someone to object. You know, jurors would have to have access to technology. There was a lot of things that were in this bill that would have provided some uniformity statewide to conduct these proceedings. Well, HB 3611 passed in the House, but it died in the Senate. It got a hearing, but it really didn't get anywhere. When that happened, shortly after that, there was already an omnibus court bill that's on the House side that deals with things such as creating new courts and various other things can happen with respect to courts generally. This remote proceeding language is added to that bill, and it passed the House, but it died in the Senate. So what that tells me, and it's pretty obvious, is that there's a big problem in the Senate on these remote proceedings. The House was, it wasn't unanimously passed, but there was a majority of folks, obviously, and I think this crosses political lines, for support for this bill in the House. But in the Senate, for whatever reason, they didn't quite like the idea. And so we're going to see something like this again. The House sponsor had told me that he had hoped to try to get it on the agenda for the special, but doesn't look like that's going to happen because I don't think there's going to be any sort of interest in the Senate. So we may see an interim charge on this, which is the studies in between sessions where the legislature will look at issues, study it, take testimony, and make recommendations for next session. But, you know, this is a big deal, as you and I, as all of y'all know. And, you know, just like mask mandates and vaccines and election, I mean, there's some hot sports opinions on both sides of this whole remote proceedings deal. So that's something that we're going to have to take a look at as we move forward, because I think we're going to have to deal with it. And I think the legislature wants to set some guidelines that everybody has to operate on. Once again, I'm talking too much, but
no, you're not. This is all great stuff. These are things that we have talked about time and time again on this podcast, especially the remote proceeding thing and kind of the future of it. And there's so much value to it, but there also, to your extent, there does have to be some standards, because right now it's just sort of a operating under emergency orders, kind of fly by the seat of your pants thing that's inconsistent across the thousands of trial courts in Texas. So it's good that they're at least looking to kind of figure out some rules.
The real sticking point on this from a practitioner perspective seems to be remote jury trials and whether people are going to be compelled to try their cases remotely to try and remove the backlog that's accumulated over the last 18 months. I know there's been some cases that have worked their way up on mandamus, but so far I'm not aware of any substantive opinions that have been written on those so far. I know there was pending at the Texas Supreme Court right now, but it's, you know, who knows how that's going to turn out. I don't think there's even been maybe full briefing requested, but it hasn't been granted. So we will see how this is going to go, because I think that's going to be a question that's going to impact the civil justice system probably almost most substantially in this is, if you don't want a remote jury trial, you're just going to have to accept that that's your fate. And that's a pretty big monumental issue to get resolved.
Well, and to your point, Todd, the feedback I got from the Senate side when I asked a few questions about what the objections were, it always came back to jury trials and evidentiary proceedings and, you know, making sure that if somebody wants a jury trial or they want to, you know, confront their witnesses face to face, you know, as opposed to remotely, then, you know, they wanted to have that right and make sure that was enshrined in whatever was passed. And I think this bill really attempted to do that because of the consent requirements. Then you start getting into, okay, so what type of proceedings, how are we going to define that? I mean, you know, devil's in the details type of deal. So there was some real heartburn on the Senate side for whatever reason about what the House had proposed. And I think it also boiled down to whether or not they really had time to address it, given the time frames in the legislative session, because we didn't really talk about this, but, you know, you only have 140 days to get something done. But then with the pandemic issues and also the freeze event in February, you know, that really compressed the time frame even further to be able to get things done. It was just really tough to do. So,
well, Jerry, you've been so great sharing your knowledge with us today. It's super helpful to those of us that practice not just civil litigation, but also appeals. You know, as we've done before with you on the show, we typically ask our guests at the end to offer a tip or a war story, but maybe the best tip, having thought about it for the last little bit, that you could offer is to remind folks how to get your legislative updates, because that is, as I said earlier, those are extremely valuable. And I would suggest to anyone, if you're even remotely interested in tracking legislation in Texas that affects civil litigation, to get on Jerry's list.
Absolutely.
How can people do that?
Well, the easiest thing to do would just be to shoot me an email. I'm at J as in Jack, D as in David, B as in boy, at ALL-lawfirm.com. That's all lowercase. And just shoot me an email, say, hey, I want on the list. And it's easy to do. It doesn't cost anything. During a regular session, you'll get updates from me, you know, if not weekly, at least every couple of weeks, depending on where we are on the session. And during the specials, I don't send those out as often unless there's something that interests us. But, you know, like I said, I'm happy to add anybody to the list and keep it neutral. It's, you know, I don't provide commentary. But the emails have links to the bill text and to committee hearings and sponsors. So you can, you know, there's as much detail in there as you want. I try not to overdo it. But anyway, I enjoy doing it and I think it's helpful to some.
It is very helpful.
You know, so I'm happy to add you.
It really is. Well, you heard it. So if you're not already on Jerry's list, get on there. And thanks again, as always, for listening. And Jerry, thanks for being with us today.
Yes, thank you so much.
Oh, happy to do it. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.